where the draconian rubber hits the road. And we need to make sure that these powers that we do give to the FSB are moderated with proper levels of responsibility. So this clause, the new clause 66, we accept that it needs to be there. But my proposal is that we delete 22 sub 2 4. So everything from the bottom half of page 16 on the B bill, the A bill, sorry, on the A list, and the whole of page 17 down to double H on page 18. So just to repeat myself for clarity's sake, it would be 22 2 subsection 4. And the reason for that, Chair, is because if we are wanting to give the FSB management and staff the permission to reveal certain information, the powers are perfectly adequate in terms of 2A subclause 1, which allows them to utilize or disclose information in the course of performing functions under or as enabled by the acts referred to in subsection 1. That's the FSB Act, other Financial Services Board legislation, and sections of the FIC Act. I think that is more than enough, particularly when you combine it with number 2 and 3 below, which allow you to reveal the information in legal proceedings or when required to do so by a court. I think those powers are perfectly adequate, and I don't see the need for extending them for this whole long list of other reasons. Let it be in terms of those relevant acts or in terms of when you have permission or request from a court. Thank you, Chair. Danny?
Thank you very much. Now, the precise functions that are enumerated in paragraph, subparagraph 4 and, basically subparagraph 4 are particularly critical functions of financial sector regulators that relate to the protection of the public when there's about the business of a financial institution, when they might be improperly conducting their business, and so that one regulator could inform another regulator when there's evidence that a financial sector institution is engaging in some suspect conduct. It may not necessarily yet constitute criminal activity or an identifiable specific offense, but it is a matter that another regulator should be aware of so that they may not grant approvals or authorizations to such institutions so that then they may be carrying on activities which may potentially cause harm to other members of the public and consumers in the public. And also, the financial sector or the financial crisis of recent times has highlighted the critical nature of the need for financial sector regulators to be able to communicate effectively information that will alert regulators to when there are problems developing in the system and activities being conducted in the system that pose a threat to the financial stability and the conduct of the markets and can have serious economic impacts. And that's one of the major lessons, and on an international level, the trend is towards the need for financial sector regulators to be acting in a collaborative manner. And it's vital to be able to specifically identify that when regulators are sharing information in relation to their prudential and market conduct regulatory functions, they can do that with other regulators to ensure that overall the regulators are able to effectively regulate the financial system. This isn't about disclosing information publicly, it's primarily disclosing information between regulators so that they are then properly informed and are able to take appropriate regulatory action in terms of their legislation. And it includes both sharing of information domestically as well as internationally with other regulators. And the cross-border nature of transactions now makes that an increasingly important function. And the Financial Services Board has obligations in terms of international memoranda of understanding in the insurance sector and other sectors to be sharing certain information with other regulators to facilitate these regulatory functions. So perhaps colleagues can be adding to that.
One more? You want to say something?
I think Janine's covered it adequately. I think I just wanted to make the broader point since my name has been attached to this. I don't think it is. I think that, you know, all the international meetings you go to after 2008, it's about sharing of information between the regulators. If we don't do this, we will be in trouble with meeting many international standards. And that's not to say that our regulators shouldn't be accountable. I think that that is an issue, and I appreciate that point. But I do think this, you know, we've heard too much on the side that information can't be shared, and frankly, that has crippled the regulators when they act and given them every excuse not to act because each one can say they didn't know. So I want to be able to say to Mr. Shidi, you knew that, and that we're holding this against your performance.
It's also important to note that the regulators still are bound by the Protection of Personal Information Act and other applicable legislation. This is just seeking to make it clear the circumstances in which, in carrying out their regulatory functions, it will be permissible for them to be sharing specified types of information in a manner that will be considered to be compliant in terms of the overall regulatory framework and the legislative framework. So generally, the regulators are bound by the Protection of Personal Information legislation. We're just wanting to ensure that it's very clear what activities, information sharing activities, are able to be undertaken, and ensure that when acting in accordance with the legislation and carrying out these activities, there won't be unnecessary problems encountered by the regulators in carrying out their functions. We just wanted to ensure that there's clarity, legal clarity, for the regulators and for the public as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I've noted recently that Dr. Van Zyl from Sanlam was quite concerned in an article where he said that overregulation might cripple the industry, and that there was good interaction between, of course, Treasury, the regulators, and industry, and especially ASISA. So that we welcome, and I hope that we can make progress in this regard, because it's exactly in this regulatory framework that South Africa is well known to have done exceptionally well during the recession and the impact of the economic crisis worldwide. And is it not then possible that the current regulations as it is then well established and that we are now over-regulating to a certain extent? Because you expressed this concern that there's a new raft of legislation and regulations coming up, and that it might cripple this industry. So we have to be sensitive if we have a success record as to the present. And we have to congratulate Treasury and the previous ministers in terms of these regulations. We've done extremely well. In terms of the World Economic Forum, we were rated, I think, 1, 2, and 3. And especially in this area of the regulation, we were highly recommended in terms of international standards. And sharing perhaps the view of my colleague that let us be careful in terms of just moving to an over-regulated system where things are working for us. International standards, perhaps the international community could have learned from us in the past. They were not as well equipped as South Africa. We are leaders in this regard. Our financial sector system is, for institutions, are rated among the best in the world. I think where there's intervention needed, my opinion is, of course, with regard to the cost of the products, and I think we're addressing that very well. And I'd like to add my voice to a concerned group that say, let us be aware that we might over-regulate. Because I would like to commend Treasury at this point in time. I think you've done a great job so far. And it shows in the results, and it shows in the respect of the international community. But as to the current situation, we have to be very careful in terms of over-regulating. Thank you.
Okay, look, you know, You know, the problem with, well, not the problem, the thing about the financial sector is we can't be complacent. Yes, we were ahead in some cases, but we mustn't be complacent. There are weaknesses. And a lot of the provisions, even what Dr. Van Zyl has raised, is happening overseas. And in a way, we've got to be a follower, because if you're not, you know, if you're money laundering, let's say there's a money laundering exchange to comply with the FIC, you might find one of our banks gets, or institutions gets into trouble with the New York state regulator. It can do enormous damage. So the point is that these are clauses, some of them, the exchange of information is one of the big issues taken up, both in the FSAP review that the IMF and World Bank conduct, and the peer review which is done by the Financial Stability Board. So these mechanisms are quite important. They're quite central. They by themselves won't lead to more regulation, by the way, because this is about exchanging information. It's more about enforcement, therefore. I think we take the point. We're not trying to be ahead of regulation, but at the moment we are following, and so we do need to actually catch up. There's a good likelihood we'll have another FSAP next year or the year after. We are due for a new one. We did ours in 2010. You've got to do it every 5 years. So we do have to have these in place. So, I mean, these themselves won't increase the regulatory provisions. And let me say, that's a very legitimate discussion to have. I think even once we pass the bill, where we are, where do we stand? Honorable Ross, I think we agree with that, but I think, you know, global events do, if you want to be part of the globally integrated world, and we're talking about the most capitalist of countries, US, UK, Europe, they've moved very fast, and we actually can't be left behind if we want to continue to work in, through those countries. And remember, what regulators have is a passport system. So they approve something, an investment framework, alternative investments framework. For us to operate in Europe, deal with derivatives, you've got to make sure that our regulators, when they regulate, that they accept the standards that we have. Otherwise, all our companies will have to go and get, for example, could go and have to go to all of those regulators. So I think this for me is quite a critical area, the exchange of information.
I think, Chair, that's why I gave it the name that I did. I was only making a joke, but I know this is important to the DDG. Chair, can I just slowly take us through 22.1 and 2? Very simply, 22.1 says, in terms of these pieces of legislation, no one can say anything or use any information that they get in performing any power or function under these acts. Then 22.2 says, if you did get information whilst using these acts, you can only utilize or disclose that information in the course of performing functions under or as enabled by the Act, including the FSB Act, other Financial Services Board legislation, or the FIC Act, certain sections of it. What I'm saying is that that's sufficient. Let the Act decide what information you can utilize and disclose. There's no need to then go on under subsection 4 and list this long list of other cases where you may or may not be able to use the information. So in a sense, I agree with Janique. You do need to have this information sharing, but it's all provided for in terms of your, in terms of the course of your performing functions under or as enabled by those acts. And to Momo, I'd like to, you say that there have been information failures that have crippled regulators. Can you give me an example of one that wouldn't have been allowed now in terms of those acts, in terms of performing functions under or as enabled by those acts? Because what I'm saying, Chair, is essentially that those powers are relatively broad, and there's no need to extrapolate and build on them. Thank you.
Chair, thank you very much. Listening to Honorable Harris, I think it's very clear to me that he's not like opposed to, I mean, the listing. What is it that needs to be disclosed? But it's just opposed to this elaboration and enumeration of what needs to be disclosed. And truly speaking, if you obviously bring a linkage between what has been said as to our compliance to international standards, but also compliance to the normal practice within the financial sector, I don't see any harm for us, I mean, to be not in favor of being specific about areas that need to be, that need some form of disclosure. And really, I find it a bit contradictory to the way we have been conducting our business, especially if you look at the trend around issues of double taxation. I mean, at the center of double taxation's agreement that went through this committee, I mean, the gist of our debate has been about appropriate disclosure and disclosure that are able, I mean, to be obviously compared with disclosures in other countries that we are doing business with. So from where I'm sitting, really is we are advancing our argument on the basis of ensuring that there is compliance or compatibility between our systems and the systems of those countries that we are doing business with. I'm comfortable with the specifications, I mean, to be made in this act. And I really don't see any harm, because from where I'm sitting, I don't think it's a poll. It's basically opposed to this disclosure being specified. But also, as correctly summarized by Momo, there's no over-regulation here. It's just a matter of ensuring that we make these provisions clearer to avoid ambiguity, but also to avoid unnecessary litigation, which might be possible if some of these things are not clarified. Thank you, Chair.
Followed by Jenny.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Maybe we need to note what the Honorable Harris has said, warning us not to find ourselves regulating more than it should be necessary. But with the explanation that you are getting from Janine and Momo here around us, because of the global standing of South Africa and the participation of South Africa in the financial sector globally, we cannot allow laxity. We cannot be complacent. Because once you become complacent, tomorrow tables will turn around and then you find yourself being led by countries which you should have not given any space to come closer to you, because the competition now in the financial sector needs this kind of aspects to be looked into so that we can be ahead in terms of preparing for the future. Engosila.
Thank you very much. In providing some further explanation as to the necessity for specifying some of the additional functions in subparagraph 4 of the section, up to this point in the legislation, the financial sector legislation, information sharing per se has really not been specifically dealt with clearly. And part of this is probably because in the past, the issue of when information can be shared has not really been specifically and as clearly regulated as we are moving to now, particularly with the Protection of Personal Information Bill. And the way that the Protection of Personal Information Bill is set up, it specifies that unless a regulator can point explicitly in a piece of legislation that this is a function that it is authorized to carry out in terms of law, then it will encounter difficulties in sharing information in relation to that function. So some of the key functions that financial sector regulators are actually carrying out in the past have not been explicitly set out in the legislation. They've more the way the legislation has been drafted, it's more sort of provided the powers to the regulators to carry out the function. But it hasn't necessarily set out that these are the functions of these particular regulators. And so particularly when you're thinking about the vital functions of macroprudential and market conduct regulation, the way the powers have been set out in the legislation so far, for instance, it authorizes registrars to take action in certain circumstances and to do certain things. But it doesn't necessarily explicitly say this is overall the function, the overall objectives that the regulators are supposed to be achieving. So some of these critical functions have not been explicitly dealt with in legislation, and that was one of the key concerns that we identified that the financial sector regulators would face in relation to the implementation of the Protection of Personal Information Bill. And so that was why we specifically identified that we needed to explicitly state this in legislation so that it is clear from a legal perspective that these regulators have these functions to be protecting financial stability and protecting the public, etc. And so then it will be clear there won't be any possible issues arising that they can share information to carry out these functions. So it was a definite shortcoming that we identified in the legislation and we determined was necessary to address through these particular provisions. So we did a careful analysis of the legislation and what it currently says, and we identified that this was an area that needed to be explicitly addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. I think, honorable members, clearly from our own conversation and deliberations, there's no objection for the 166. The issue that Honorable Harris raised is an over-elaboration of what is it that needs to be reported and all those things, the information sharing. And from where we're sitting, as much as we all know that we are in this kind of an economic challenge as a country and world over, precisely because some of these issues were not clearly spelled out in terms of the regulatory environment. In fact, we relied more on self-risk assessment internationally and self-regulatory. And the regulatory institutions also did not do enough. They relied on financial institutions, on the financial sector in general, to be more self-prudent and so on and so forth. I think this elaboration that's in this clause, we should actually commend National Treasury for taking the trouble to go to such an extent or to detail and become so explicit so that there's no confusion of what is it that's supposed to be done as we move on. And on that note, I think we should accept the proposal. Agreed? Thank you. Clause 67. Clause 67.
That's the second one that I would refer to by the name I gave earlier, Chair, because clearly we've debated this at length in the committee. But clearly, if we exempt the FSB officials from gross negligence, which is effectively what we're doing by deleting those words, we're saying that they are allowed to act with serious carelessness, which you'll remember we established was the sort of layman's definition of gross negligence. It means if FSB officials act with serious carelessness, that's fine. They can do that with impunity. And I don't think, as we've discussed, as we heard from many of the presenters, that is acceptable. We do not want a case where they can act grossly negligently and get away with it. Because we've specified gross negligence, it still means that FSB
point of order,
could perhaps...
Point of order. Chair,
I remember it very well. It was in G26, just behind the assembly, when, as a committee, and we even noted the concern by the DA. That's why you are not seeing any amendment on this clause on the A list, Chair. Now, why are we then going back, Chair? That's the point of what I'm asking.
Okay. Tim? The answer is there should have been an amendment if you went with our arguments, because we were saying that we should not delete those words. As far as I understand, they are still being deleted because the B bill says they should be. I would love if the A bill restored them, but they don't. It doesn't. So we still have the issue of the gross negligence being removed as a condition. So the concern not only of ourselves but of many of the presenters in the public hearings remain. I'll just remind you what a thesis, if I've got that wrong, please someone interrupt me from Treasury, but I'm pretty sure that's the case. Chair, a thesis said, it is inconceivable that an official of the FSB who causes damage or losses by acting in a grossly negligent manner should be afforded protection against claims in respect of such damage or losses suffered. I think that was pretty much a general view of many of the presenters, and it's certainly one with which I have, we have sympathy with. The FSB in this legislation is given far-reaching and even, as the DDG calls it, draconian powers. Now, I'm only content at giving those powers if they're balanced with greater accountability. And I think this holding them accountable for gross negligence is the very lowest level of accountability that we can, in good faith, impose here. At some point, Treasury acknowledged that giving these additional powers to the FSB needs to be balanced by that accountability. So I think this is one clause where we can make that a reality check. With great power comes great responsibility, as they say in Spider-Man, but I think it rings true. And letting them off the hook on gross negligence is quite simply too low a level of accountability, and we need to correct it by leaving those words in the law.
Amendment? Momo?
Look, I mean, I'm not unsympathetic to what I think Honourable Harris is raising. And I do think the issue of accountability is very important, especially when there's an abuse of power or people are acting in bad faith. But I think, you know, we've got an opinion which I just want to members to note from Advocate Provia, because we were asked to get an opinion. And I think generally what you'll find in this opinion is the way our law works, it's not just the FSB, it's a whole host of other entities. This is a standard way in which you deal with these issues. Now, I'm not saying that's the best way, and so on, and certainly when you look at questions of accountability, I think it's not just what's written in the law, it's also say how Parliament exercises that oversight function. I think a lot of these things could be done better, but I'm not sure what offer we have on the table. The gross negligence story actually doesn't solve any problem, and I would contend, in fact, make things a bit worse, and in fact would make it harder for people to prove, to succeed actually. So I don't know, Honourable Harris, if you have the opinion, it was in the fact that you put out, yeah. So, and I mean, you see there that there's a number of others. So, you know, if this were a broader review of public entities and accountability, yes, let's look at it. But I think in this specific instance, I think really the gross negligence story would make things worse, frankly.
Yeah, Chair, my request is that Momojan must just indicate which package, because you know we have to see so many documents.
Oh.
Which package are you referring to, so we can all follow?
If you look at the document that's to support the report back from the last time, there was a written document, so it will be, yeah. And as an annexure there, you will find, Janine, you want to talk through where exactly the document is?
Yes, it should be like an extra 8 or 9. I think 8 and 9 are two legal opinions that we obtained. Yes.
And to that, you know, if you look at the actual the document that you were showing, Honorable Pandruya, this main document, final draft submission to the standing committee, okay, we dealt with this issue firstly, just as a written response. So if we get to page 10, okay, and you'll see whether it's the Banks Act, the Labor Relations Act, the, you know, social services. I'm just trying to show you how widespread this is, okay? And read together with Advocate Provier's opinion. I think we just want to get this back to what's the standard across, which is not to say that the issues that, as I said, Honorable Harris has raised of accountability, I think do need to be looked at, and certainly when we're doing the Twin Peaks legislation, we are looking at that. So, you know, this is like holding action, better in mind. But there are broader issues that we have to take into account.
Chair, I just want to make it crystal clear for the committee. The question is, do we want FSB officials to be held liable when they act with serious carelessness or not? I think as public representatives, we should find that idea a problem. You cannot have officials of an important regulator being able to act with impunity with serious carelessness. They have, but you know, if we leave it in as bona fide exercise of any power, they are not allowed to. They're exempt from straightforward negligence. Anyway, that's fine. I accept that. But gross negligence means that they are seriously careless, and I think that, as I said, that level of accountability is too low. I think simply retaining the words there as they were drafted in by this committee in 1990, that was good legislating back then. I don't see any reason to change what the decision this committee took in 1990 to specify gross negligence.
Now, let me just find more said the grossly negligent in session. If I had to correct it, would not necessarily make matters easy or to make matters difficult, something like that. What do you say?
Let Janine come in, but to Janine, prove that. Or Olano, maybe. Okay.
Janine?
In the legal opinion, particularly from paragraphs 11, 12, and 13, Advocate Favia discusses about whether or not including the wording gross negligence or not really would provide any benefit or perhaps even make things unnecessarily complicated. It is quite difficult to be determining... It is quite difficult to be determining when does negligence precisely become gross negligence, and that leads to a lot of complications in court cases. But if an official is clearly acting in a way that is seriously careless or reckless, it will be very likely that such conduct could not be considered to be in good faith. It would be found to have been acting in bad faith. Because if you're acting in good faith, you will be acting in a conscientious manner. So the point he was making is that whether or not grossly negligent is in there or not doesn't really assist, and it in fact can make things more complicated and lead to more court actions. So it doesn't necessarily assist in holding officials accountable to a higher degree. The degree of accountability will be very similar. Thank you.
Judith, Honorable Chavalala, and Van Royen, and
thanks, Chair.
Honorable
Ross.
Thanks, Chair. I think from the explanation that we're getting, Chair, I think one, I will move that we accept it as is or on the limitations of liability. I mean, I think on the opinion that we're given, it's quite clear when it comes to issues of officials acting rather than not being malicious, because it says that if officials from their liability for loss or damage that may be caused to other persons when the FSB and its officials perform their official function under the FSB statutory umbrella, in a bona fide but not grossly negligent. So from where I'm sitting, Chair, I think it quite covers the issue to say here you are not trying to have punitive measures when officials are doing their own work, because circumstances cannot prevail and say when they're going to go there, ultimately they might act otherwise, because now we're starting to sniff whether they will be acting in good faith or not. So, but I think how it's written, Chair, is proper. We don't want any legal matters to proceed beyond what is it that the intention of the law is. Thanks.
Yeah, just very quickly, you know, the point that if we don't cite gross negligence, will then be maybe setting free any wrongdoing from the register or maybe FSB official. I don't think it's appropriate, because if we insist to insert that this is not or maybe omission is done by the person in a bona fide, not necessarily in a bona fide way, then that doesn't imply that person is not necessarily, we are not saying that person is free from any wrongdoing. So I think that conclusion is not correct. So I think in my take, I mean, the way this amendment, the way it is captured, there's no problem with it.
Yes, just to comment with what happened at the Ponzi schemes with regard to the Banks Act. I know it's a bit not perhaps on topic. But then my question to the CEO of the FSB, I think perhaps your views in terms of accountability, I would like to hear from you. But what happened in that case is there was directives given by, I think, Advocate Blackbear, to intervene in a Ponzi scheme and
later the chair, on... Or the chair, the member is out of order, Chair. This is not the matter on the table. We're talking about Clause 67, yeah? Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I'm making an analogy to the present situation, if the member understands. With regards to that intervention, it was later then revised by a court order that the directive should be withdrawn. That, you know, it's a very serious circumstances what then happened, that a lot of, we had dormant assets, we had 400 people losing their investments. Nobody, there was no win-win situation whatsoever for anybody in the situation because of a premature intervention, I believe. Doing regulation, I believe, and that's why the question is related to you, sir. I think it's a very tough job, and I think, you know, those interventions are very unpleasant, and it's not easy, I think. But certainly you would like to be protected in terms of your accountability, what you can do, what you can't do. And what would your views be in terms of this, taking the example in terms of what happened in the Bank Act? Because those situations are not yet resolved, and it's quite possible that there's now a major action in terms from industry against the Reserve Bank. And I've asked the Reserve Bank Governor for a personal interview in this regard to this, to see if we can find some clarity and way out, to see that we can somewhere create perhaps a win situation for investors that have lost a lot. And I hope the analogy is relevant.
I'm not trying to relate to the defense of my colleague, but Treasury cites the Banks Act actually as one of the examples in the response to the issue. And the issue, the incident that Honourable Ross is referring to happened despite the fact that the Banks Act in Section 88, this is page 11 of the Treasury's final submission, despite the fact that the Banks Act goes with the weaker accountability by limiting to the registrar or other official or employee in the bona fide performance of any function or duty under this Act. I think that's an excellent example, the Treasury's quoted themselves, where we didn't go far enough in the Banks Act. Let's not make that same mistake. Let's specify that if you act with with serious carelessness, you're not let off the hook. Okay, Didi?
Thank you, Chair. I think the response is here, and I've said it before. Your critical words here are whether you're acting in good faith or you're acting with malice. Regulators are not people from anywhere. They remain people like you, Honourable Member. Mistakes can be made. But is that mistake couched under negligence, I mean under malice, bad malice or good intentions? If you don't draw that line, who are you going to have as a regulator? And secondly, by insisting on having gross negligence being there, you're actually making it extremely difficult for consumers to go to court and prove gross negligence. They won't do it because it's such a complex, complex concept. You're not going to assist them. But if you say, if the regulator acts maliciously, of course he must be held accountable. To me, that's as straightforward as that.
Okay. So the answer to the question that was put to me is that you will have people as regulators that don't act seriously carelessly. That's the bottom line. It's not simply about acting in good faith or not. It's about making sure that you're not seriously careless. You can still be careless. You could still could be some degree of negligence, but not gross negligence.
I think in the first instance we should move from the premise that says the register or whoever is a fit and proper person that exercises these responsibilities. Any other thing, if we try to preempt that, we'll not be able to build in clauses in the Act to protect everybody. In fact, for me, it's who are we trying to protect? Is it the consumer or the practitioners in the industry? In terms of this Act.
Directly, the point of the regulator is to protect both.
Yeah.
And acting in a seriously careless manner is not acceptable, and we need to specify that in the law as it's already specified. I don't see any reason to take it out.
Now, okay. Great.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think we are dealing with the Act here, and the spirit of the Act is just to make someone, to make limitation in terms of liability, and that's what we are doing, to say no one will be liable of any loss and the or damage caused as a result of doing work that is supposed to do at that particular time. In terms of other issues pertaining to whether negligence or none, we have regulations that have to come, we have policies that will be developed, that will be able then to further include what we want to see, the spirit, to further all the other issues that we want to be covered in. Here we are dealing with the law and it can be, you know, word by word in terms, otherwise we'll write a book if we have to do laws like that. What determines what we mean by this will be other supporting documents that will be developed after this. But in terms of the Act, I think we have covered it quite well. Thank you.
When I spoke, I said, Chair, I'm moving. That's what I said. I'm moving that we leave it as is. I think the understanding we get and we understand where the Honourable Member is coming from as far as raising a concern to say how do we hold people accountable and liable. However, we are saying that when we employ people, don't employ them in thinking that they might not hold the standard in their employ. Where we are sitting, we're saying bona fide, because you must also prove beyond reasonable doubt on other matters that really they acted outside their jurisprudence that they have to do that. So in the spirit of saying that where regulators their under statutory functions and have exercised them in good faith, I think we're fine, Chair, where we are sick. So I'm moving, Chair, that we proceed. Thanks.
Want to speak to that? Fine. Honorable Harris?
I disagree because in this bill we're giving the regulator more powers, even draconian powers. Not my word. But we're lowering the standard of accountability at the same time. It can't be correct to do that. So I maintain that we need to leave those words in there, not remove them.
You seem to be losing that debate.
Okay, Chair. If I'm losing that debate, I object to that, of course.
Thank you.
But I have a compromise, perhaps. It's not my compromise. It's a compromise from ACESA with their proposal. I mean, I'm by no means happy to concede my position, but in the interest of making progress, ACESA said we should delete bona fide, leave not grossly negligent, and then add at the end of the clause, provided that such person acted in a bona fide manner and with due skill, care, and diligence. And I think that might be a middle way that we could support.
All right.
You know, just unfortunately, just as a comment, that even the legal advices that our department for an extra mile to acquire seems not to be making sense to my honorable member, Honorable Harris. Because if you look into legal advice, I mean, the paragraph 11 and 12 that you have been referred to, I mean, it's so explicit on what is it that we need to do. I wonder maybe we need to call in once again Advocate Jenkins maybe to reiterate his previous advice to the committee on this matter to convince other areas, but I'm very sure that that's still not going to help. And definitely, Chair, I'm not convinced that the reasons forwarded are the only reasons, I mean, for us not to accommodate this. And really, it's very unfortunate for us not even to be heeding to the advice of those who are well, I mean, vested with how to deal with some of these matters. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'm here to move and second what has been moved by Honorable Judith Shabalala.
No, as a Chair, I don't have much to say. But, you know, listen to the FSB, Momo. And, you know, sometimes it's gut feelings. It may not be right. Do we have to say, but not grossly negligent, or we just have to stop with in the bona fide? Because to prove grossly negligent in a court of law, it's just a mountain. It's a mountain. In fact, I think this clause was properly captured. What makes it difficult is when we try to say we must lower the standard of accountability. I mean, we must up the standard of accountability for the officials. And you insert this thing of but not grossly negligent. For me, if it was my cause, I would expunge this word and leave. I mean, this addition, but not grossly negligent, expunge it and leave this text as it is. From where you're sitting is lowering the standards, but I don't think so, because we are a constitutional democracy. It's for the court to determine at some point whether a person has acted in mala fide or in bona fide. So I think putting this grossly negligent for me is a very big problem.
Can I get it from yourself, Momo, if you insist with this?
I think we agree with you that you need to take out those words because they introduce problems. And that's not to say that we aren't taking the issues of accountability. And I think that's a legitimate discussion. I think the example that Uncle Ross raised, let's go into those examples because none of these things are panaceas.
Yeah.
But I think let's at least go back to a reasonable level that and we recognize we need to build in the accountability mechanisms, I think, for all day.
Can we agree on that, Honourable Members? Honourable Harris?
I'm afraid I don't agree. I think the law was perfectly well designed before and there's no need to remove it. It simply means that this committee tolerates serious carelessness on the part of the regulator, and I don't think that's acceptable. I'm also dismayed that I make a further proposal that's a concession of sorts that it isn't even considered at all.
Is your problem is that you think what you propose, it must be a subject of discussion. We're discussing the Act here, not what you put into the Act all the time. And I think that's a problem. Earlier on, we had a rejection. You made a proposal and wanted somebody to reject it, not even the content of the bill before end of break. So you must have two approvals. Your ideas, first, whether it is accepted by the committee or not, it must be rejected before you then reject the content and the subject matter that you're dealing with. So you have made a proposal. Nobody's making a follow-up on that. So it can be that we should actually debate what we are saying. If nobody follows it up, it's okay. Let's move on.
I have the same rights as every single member of this committee. I can propose to change laws, to add, to amend.
I agree.
It sounds like you're restricting those rights.
No.
Please explain what you're saying again.
I agree with you, but it's not a condition for the committee to proceed what you are saying. So I've said, in terms of what we are discussing here, listening carefully, what introduces a difficulty is the insertion of but not grossly negligent. Let's delete it. And I've consulted in your presence here. So I'm saying, is that okay with the committee member? And almost everybody says yes, and you say you have made an amendment. And nobody's talking to that amendment. And that is the problem. We should consider your amendment.
I don't recall saying that. I would be surprised about that. What I meant is I'm proposing an amendment like any member in the committee can do.
Let's protect 2 months. You see, there's a committee meeting, and you're the chair of the committee, and you must be respected. It cannot be that it's allowed that there's dialogue between yourself and the speaker. The speaker must be noticed to speak. That's the first order. The second order is that...
You speak through me. If you continue to rebut members when they speak in this meeting, through my permission, you'll have to decide whether they want to be part of the deliberations or not. It cannot be. Okay.
Thank you, Chief.
Proceed, Judith.
Thank you, Chief.
No, it's no point of order. Proceed, Judith.
Thank you, Chief. The second order on the member is the issue around accusing further the committee when it has made deliberations to say that the committee is careless and it tolerates the register's carelessness. It can't be, Chairperson. That is not the spirit of our deliberations, and that's not what we intend to do when we make legislation. So we take exception around that. We apply our mind to the legislation of the day, and we cannot simply be accused of that at the end of everything else because an issue was not taken into the committee. Everybody has got the right to make amendment, to make anything that they want to see added. That does not necessarily mean it's going to be agreed by everybody. Now, you've allowed a democratic process, Chair. We've done it, all of us. You've consulted, and we've moved, Chair, and we've been seconded that this move. The Honourable Member simply just registered the objection. Can you proceed with the meeting, Chair?
Honourable Ross.
Thank you. I'd
just like some clarity with regards to the follow-up proposal from Honourable Harris, where he then mentioned that the CISA made a recommendation which would be a second option to get us out of the deadlock, that we at least try and move towards a consensus decision on this, which of course we all prefer. And the CISA has always been very helpful in terms of interaction with Treasury and hopefully with the regulators as well. And if they made those proposals and committing the bona fides, it's very technical and I haven't got it in front of me, unfortunately, but the CISA has always made very good recommendations. Is it not possible that we can just have a study or quickly what those recommendations is and perhaps it's a way forward for a consensus decision?
Chair, let's not deviate from the committee known procedures of dealing with these matters. I mean, that submission that is being referred to, the submission that was obviously came with other submissions from other public stakeholders. So I don't think it will be appropriate for us. Of course, it's fine for us to consider that this should deliver right now. But then we can now go back and say, let's look into specific submissions made by individual stakeholders. For now, we need to come out after considering all the submissions and to conclude as a committee on this matter. And I think there was a suggestion, and I think we need to conclude the matter and just check if maybe how much of us support the proposed suggestion on the support of this provision change with the necessary amendment. Thank you.
I think I had almost summarized our deliberations. And I was saying, and this is a proposal that I've made to the committee, that we leave Section 67 as is and expunge, but not grossly negligent. National Treasury has said, and the FSB, they seem to be comfortable with that. Agreed? 68? Harris?
I don't agree.
Fine.
And I'd like to formally propose another option. Propose, I'm not demanding, that we go with your suggestion, but we add at the end, provided that such person acted in a bona fide manner and with due skill, care, and diligence, which is in line with the recommendation made to us by a CISA.
Where? What's this? Is that you? What? Okay. No, okay. Grace?
Chair, I think the matter, there was a mover and a seconder. The honourable member must just tell us whether he is objecting and we finalise and we go. Because these other issues, as indicated before, were as a result of whatever that was received prior. So that has been accommodated. If it's not included, it means it was not relevant at that particular time. So we cannot start again and go back to where the submissions were made before the document that is before us. So what we are saying, Chair, is that we need to move, and the member must not technically take us back because he's actually taking us back, ignoring the fact that we have moved and seconded. Whenever he has to say, I object, I want to raise my objection, he starts another debate. So can we move, Chair?
I'm going to make a ruling now. Yeah, we've been on this matter since lunch. 67 is going to remain as is with the amendments of expanding what I've said earlier on. Honorable Harris, we have noted your objection. Thank you.
May I answer the question posed by this honorable member?
No, thank you. Thank you. We are now on 68. No, we are now on 68, honorable members.
Jillian?
Clause 68. The amendment is just to a very slight amendment. It is just mainly so that in subsection 4B, it would, at the beginning of subsection 4, paragraph B, we would insert wording subject to section 22. And this is just intended to align that provision with the amendments that we are proposing to section 22 to ensure that there's appropriate alignment between that provision and the what is said in subsection 4B. So that is it's quite a minor amendment, just to ensure the alignment between the provisions. Thank you. Legislation that deals with on-site visits and inspections, and we're amending it similarly to the earlier provision that we dealt with in the Pension Funds Act. So this is part of the overall alignment process. Thank you.
Thank you. 73, 74, 75, no amendments. 76.
In Section 76, the first amendment is to enable the registrar to take action when, in the opinion of the registrar, an insurer is or an entity is not managed or owned by persons who are fit or proper or managed in accordance with the governance and risk management framework that would be prescribed by the registrar. So it's intended to enhance the ability of the registrars to take action when it's identified that governance of the entity in terms of appropriate governance principles that will be prescribed. So it will be very clear what the principles are, the framework that they will be required to comply with. Clause 100, it is just intended just to clarify the provision as it was identified that the wording was not as clear as it ideally could be. So we're just refining the wording. Four is again dealing with the on-site visits.
One or two, I've just lost you on the last one. If you can just give me a sec, I will appreciate it. I'm sorry.
Is dealing with the on-site visits again. It's similar to the other wording. And 118 is also similar to what we dealt with in 76.
the same as 102.
Given that the clauses are identical, although they apply to different acts, what I say with regards to 140 applies as much to 102. The first proposal is that the minister should be able to do this, not the registrar. We've discussed this in committee before, and I think there was some consensus from some of the presenters that that would be good practice. So that's my first proposal, that the second word becomes minister rather than registrar. And then I propose that after minister, we insert the words may, subject to subsection 4, and such other or further consultation as may be required in terms of section 3.2 of the Financial Services Board Act 1990, by notice in the Gazette. Would you like me to carry on? Then, Chair, under subsection... This applies to 102 and 140. They're the same text.
Well, on 140 now.
Well, I don't think you could change 140 without changing 102.
Honourable Member, if you want to speak, speak through me. We are on 140. Can you talk to 140?
Right. Well, you've got my first proposal, Chair. The second is that under subsection 4A2, we insert the words "and any public comments received" between the words "rules" and "to Parliament." And in the next line, between the words scrutiny and at, we insert the words and approval. So you require parliamentary scrutiny and approval, not simply scrutiny. And then under 62.4c, after consideration of any comments received in response to the publication, and then insert the words after obtaining parliamentary approval following tabling of the draft. Those are my proposals. Jenny?
Well, with respect to the amendments that were proposed in respect of subsections, section 4, oh, sorry, trying to... the wording of subsection 4 is consistent with the wording of similar provisions in the Financial Markets Act and the Credit Rating Services Act about publication, like tabling of and submission of rules and regulations to Parliament before they're finalized and promulgated. Oh, the Credit Rating Services Act, sorry, and the Financial Markets Act. Do you want to say
anything? You want to say? Just comment?
The provision of the rules to Parliament is similar to what was proposed in the Credit Rating Services Act last year. So that is correct. That is aligned.
So this is in line.
Yeah. I don't know whether the committee wants me to comment on the first proposal of
the
empowering the minister rather than the registrar. I think they, in the bundle, is also a comprehensive opinion on the delegation of powers, which explains why it's appropriate in these circumstances to have the registrar making these rules and the practicalities of that.
Okay. Honourable members? Agreed.
Honourable Harris.
Chair, before I respond, can I just say that I always appreciated the spirit with which we legislated in this committee. And it's always been personified up until now by generosity and respect.
Of the chair?
Of everybody, Chair. I think of all of us.
Okay.
And unfortunately, there are some members here, unfortunately, I don't even know who they are, that are not personifying
the spirit. Can I just stop you, Tim? Can I just stop you there? You have made proposals. Don't paraphrase your input. But the gestures that you make amongst yourselves, because I've been observing that, so that is not part of the meeting. Make your input in terms of your proposals and the responses that are here.
I said I will do that in a second, Chair, but I was addressing you on the point with which you briefed me when I joined this committee. That you prefer to legislate by consensus, which is something that I acknowledge, and I've tried to operate by that spirit. So unfortunately, today we seem to have changed the approach. And I was simply going to request that you brief new members of this committee on that same approach, because
yesterday there was a committee meeting, and some Chapter 9 institution came to present an annual report. And in that process, that person tried to teach members of the committee what their responsibilities and duties are. I fully believe that members of the committee are here, they fully understand their responsibilities, and they don't need to be educated by anybody. Make your input, or else if there's no any other thing that you want to say on 140, we proceed. If you object, because already there is a view that says we should accept these amendments as they are presented to us. Comment on that?
Chair, I've made these proposals for good reason. I believe it should be the minister that we give these powers to, not the registrar. I hope the committee members can see that. And secondly, we need to enhance Parliament's role in this process. The amendments that I've proposed will not just require Parliament to scrutinise, but actually to approve. I'm suggesting that we can enhance the power of this institution, and we should in this law. And it's some very simple amendments that basically insert the requirements of approval from Parliament, not simply scrutiny and publication. That's all. I'm suggesting that members should play a stronger oversight role. As my second point and my first point, as I covered, is that these should be published by the minister, not the registrar.
Judith?
Thanks, Chair. Without delivering the engagement and speaking to the submission of approvement, because you don't want to also see yourself fiddling around the wake of an institution. That's one. So secondary to that, Chair, I think we're consistent with 102. And 140. So I'm saying, Chair, let's move on from there. We leave it as is. I think we are comfortable, and it's in line with the Credit Act regulation. So I don't see a problem. So, that's where I'm at. Thank you.
Okay, and for that?
Yeah, in support of that, Chair, the Minister, in terms of public administration, is a discipline, and the Registrar is a phenomenon. So at no stage where you will mix the role, the operational role or administrative role, and the decision making. So the Registrar is quite correct to be the one instead of the Minister. You can't relegate the Minister to that level.
Agreed? 141 up to, okay, Honorable Harris.
Chair, what were you essentially doing by not enhancing our own powers? We're like turkeys voting for Christmas. I am dismayed that the members of this committee can't see that, and I would like the objection of the DA noted.
Your objection is noted?
No, Chair. He must withdraw. You know, that is an insult. We are turkeys of Christmas turkeys. Who are Christmas turkeys? It's not parliamentary, Chair. The member is out of order.
Can you withdraw?
It's a turn of phrase.
You can't say this
a way that it's like a turkey being invited for Christmas.
I said this committee's acting in a way like turkeys voting for Christmas.
No, yeah, that's the thing, what I'm saying.
Turn of phrase.
No, that's what I'm saying, withdraw that. Can you withdraw that? Because these members of the committee are not doing that.
Chair?
Can you withdraw?
Are you asking me to withdraw it?
I'm asking you to withdraw that. We have noted your objection. Can you withdraw your paraphrase?
Okay, then this committee is not acting like turkeys voting for Christmas.
No. Can you withdraw?
I withdraw.
Thank you. 149.
Substituting the wording having a material interest in the matter concerned and to substitute in respect of whom such power is exercised to more appropriately define in respect of whom the registrar should be able to be acting.
Okay. Agreed. 151.
It is just proposed to omit the word reasonably, as that is necessary in terms of the promotion of administrative justice act, and that's an implied and always present requirement.
The new clause for 154.
This provision is intended to more appropriately provide for when disclosure may happen, and it is basically proposed to delete subparagraph 7 of the existing provision and just amend the other reference accordingly. Thank you.
Agreed. Honourable members. 150. Where are we now? 154. Members, if you've got no comment, it means you agree on this letter. 158. Any comment? 160.
This is the provisions that we are proposing that relate to on-site visits in order to thoroughly define and properly define certain terms and clearly define what constitutes an on-site visit and clearly provide for the powers in relation to on-site visits and when they can be exercised in order to ensure that there's proper clarity because particularly during the deliberations on the Credit Rating Services Act, it was identified that it wasn't sufficiently clear in the legislation what constitutes an on-site visit and when they may be exercised, so we're really trying to properly address that.
Good. We spend a lot of time on this, honourable members, during our deliberations. Agreed. 162. Rejected. New clause is the following. No comment. 164.
Clause 171.
I just don't think we should
put it into the law like this. We should kick it to regulations.
If you correct for delegation to just flow automatically, then there must be a center holding, which is the register. Whatever you do beneath the level of a register, it should have the authority of the register. Otherwise, it will be any body's business to do whatever, delegated.
Okay. In short, we are accepting this amendment as it is. Agreed? Honorable Harris?
Note the objection of the DA.
Noted. Thank you. 212.
Thank you, honorable members.